All right, you're listening to Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs. From Vancouver in the Lower Mainland, my name is Alex DeBoer.
I'm Max Newman.
I'm Samuel Jones.
And I'm Joshua Azizi. It's Thursday, April 24th at 5:03 p.m. We're broadcasting live from UBC Vancouver's campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkamatum-speaking Musqueam people.
Today's show will be focusing on climate change. This week, City Council had heard two reports. One is the Resilience Report, which makes recommendations on how to deal with and adapt to climate change and extreme weather. The other report focuses on how to minimize climate change in Vancouver. It offers six big recommendations for how the city can reduce its carbon emissions in the coming decades. Related, we also have a live interview for you today with journalists. Would you mind just introducing yourself real quick?
Hi, I'm Brayla. I'm in my first year at the J School.
Yeah, Brayla joins us in studio to discuss her reporting for the Thunderbird on a climate change protest that took place downtown a couple weeks ago.
But before we get to the fire and brimstone, we have some headlines from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland.
And it's not necessarily fire and brimstone. But is it? Climate change.
Maybe.
Oh. All right, first headline. Who's reading that?
Come on, Max.
Yeah, it's me. Campers at Oppenheimer Park are still waiting on the city, despite the Vancouver City Council's motion passed 6 weeks ago to help those living in Oppenheimer Park. The campers say that they have not seen much results. The campers say that they still need bathrooms they can access 24 hours a day and help finding more permanent shelters. Furthermore, the city has sent staff to clean the parks, but this has been very disruptive to those staying there. They say that they feel harassed and their belongings have gone missing or gotten wet in the rain. So the city says that they have placed 16 people in temporary modular housing so far. In January 2019, Vancouver City Council anonymously approved a motion recognizing the climate emergency. Staff were asked to provide recommendations on how to ramp up the city's climate actions in line with efforts to limit global warming to 1.5 degrees, the 1.5 degrees limitation. On Wednesday, April 24th, the city staff provided their report with six big recommendations that would guide the city of Vancouver's work in response to the climate emergency.
We have other news about parks today. 420 was last Saturday. 420 was last Saturday, coinciding with the Easter weekend. Around 150 people flocked to Sunset Beach's event to celebrate. To the sigh of organizers and first responders who were standing by, it was a relatively orderly event. 2 years ago, the 420 event at the park caused so much damage that the city had to close it for 10 weeks and last year for six. This year, though there are areas that are fenced off and being cleaned 2 days after, it seems uncertain whether the city hall will need to close it. Sergeant Jason Robillard from the Vancouver Police Department says that there were no major incidents and praised those who were involved for their teamwork. This comes in the heels of NPA Councillor Melissa DeGenova's tweet, saying that the city should seek legal action against organizers of the event in order to recover costs. Last year, the city sent them a bill for more than $200,000, which organizers say they have paid. The cost to the city for this year's event has yet to be totaled.
Right. So there was lots of drama about that on Twitter, 420, if you were following, lots of media coverage of that. So we'll see if there's any legal action the city takes to get back money they lost as a result of the 420 quote-unquote protest slash celebration. So now we're going to go to a report that was done at City Hall yesterday. Josh, Sam, and Armand, three of our News Collective members, were at City Hall, and they were there to report on a report that staff were presenting to council as a result of the city declaring a climate emergency. We're going to go right to that now, and you can hear what folks had to say. Josh spent a lot of time putting this together. Do you want to say a few words before we start it, Josh?
Don't think I have too much to say, really. Basically, the city declared a climate emergency back in January, and then they told their staff, you know, we're in a climate emergency. What are some actions that we can do in regards to this? And so the staff put the staff created a report, and they detailed six big moves for how they can address this climate emergency. Okay. And I detail those six big moves in my report.
Yeah, and you can hear sort of what it was like to be there with the people who were speaking to council, some young people, some older people, a real mix. But people want action now, so let's hear this report. Here we go.
As you probably all are aware, is a global leader when it comes to addressing climate change. And I think that there's no reason we shouldn't continue to be a leader in that. All the world cities and nations are going to need to up their game with regard to climate change. We're all like frogs in the pot of water that slowly the heat is turning up, and it's turning up faster and faster, and everybody's going to have to step up their game. So this report, I think, signals our response to your call for doing just that. And I think I will.
On January 16th, City Council passed a motion declaring a climate emergency in Vancouver. This past Wednesday, April 24th, Council heard a presentation from staff on how to best mitigate the effects of climate change. They also heard from public speakers, most of whom supported the recommendations made by staff. CITR reporters Samuel L. Jones, Armand Rana, and myself, Joshua Azizi, were at City Hall last Wednesday. We learned there's a strong demand for action on climate change from both old and young Vancouverites.
I just pressed the record button, so I guess it's recording now. I can see the timer up top. Okay.
All right, so I'm here in City Council chambers, and just looking around me right now, there's a huge range of demographics that have come out to represent whatever position they might have on this issue as speakers. There are actually more than 30 speakers and a lot of people in chambers. So you can see that this has drawn a pretty big crowd. All around me, there's people talking, people just discussing this issue, from multiple fronts. And there's a wide variety of concerns, as you can imagine, with just the sheer volume of different demographics that are here, you know. Old and young, visible minorities, majorities, it runs the gamut. So right now, I think it's going to be interesting seeing what the different speakers have to say and the sort of impressions that we might get from them after they're done talking. So yeah, we'll see how that goes.
The staff presented what they referred to as six big moves that could make Vancouver a carbon neutral city before 2050. Of these six goals, five are meant to be completed by 2030. They include ensuring that 90% of people in Vancouver live within a short walk of their daily needs, making sure that two-thirds of trips in the city are made by public transit or active transportation, reducing emissions in new construction projects to 40% of 2018's levels, increasing the amount of kilometers driven by zero-emissions vehicles in Vancouver to 50% of all kilometers traveled, and completing enough forest and coastal restoration work to remove 1 million tons of carbon pollution annually by 2016. The remaining goal is ensuring that all new replacement heating and hot water systems emit zero emissions. This goal is to be completed by 2025. Staff believes that it'll be perfectly possible to achieve these six goals, but they acknowledge that it will be a challenge.
Focus on the objectives that we think we need to move towards that align our work with that objective of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees. In total, they would help us, if we're able to achieve them, achieve that 1.2 million tons of reductions we're aiming for. We do think they're technically achievable, but to be perfectly clear, they will push our limits and also our partners' limits in the space if we're going to achieve them. They're going to require a mix of tools, both in terms of city tools, in terms of the policies we have, engagement we do, investments we make, but also working across other governments with utilities to sort of bring a full range of tools.
A whopping 31 speakers signed up to speak in response to this report, although four withdrew and council wasn't able to hear them all. The speakers presented a wide range of opinions, but they were mostly supportive of the report's recommendations.
Our response and pathway to reduced carbon emissions. We support the principal recommendations of this report. However, with our three decades of experience and expertise
on climate change action, I'm also kind of urge you, both as a scientist and as a young person, to kind of take the next step in that global action and to approve the report the city staff have put forward on.
And final reason that gains very little political traction these days, it's the right thing to do.
Thank you, Council. So my name is Jay Rogers. I'm here to encourage you to support Vancouver's Climate Emergency Response Declaration in its entirety. I'm a lifelong resident of Vancouver and have been a transit operator for 24 years. When government encourages people to stop...
However, what stood out the most was the presence of young people, particularly teenagers, both inside the Council's chambers and in front of the microphone. Many of them were from Climate Strike Canada, a collection of youth-led environmentalist groups across the country.
I'm going to start your timer now.
My name is Layla Aiken. I'm 16 years old, and I'm in favor of this entire motion. On January 16th, I stood in front of City Council and urged you all to pass Councillor Boyle's declaration of a climate emergency. The motion was passed unanimously, which means I know that each and every single one of you understand the need for bold climate action.
Around 11 years from now, we will be in a position where we set off an irreversible chain reaction beyond human control that will most likely lead to the end of our civilization as we know it. I'm only 16 years old, and I'm fighting for my life, my generation, and future generations to come. I want to live in a world where I can enjoy the outdoors and the fresh air with my family. I want to live in a world where I can raise my future children. Though this is only unless we take immediate action. The restoration of forests and coasts was addressed on the report, and I am in favor to conserve, restore, and create forests and coastal ecosystems in order to remove large...
My name is Rebecca, and I'm 16. On behalf of the affected generation, I'm begging you to support the motion in full. Yesterday, my friend sent me an excited text message. I'm part of the club now, she said. She's from London, Ontario, and was referring to the fact that her town had just declared climate emergency. Before January 16th of this year, no Canadian municipalities outside of Quebec had declared climate emergency. Now, one quarter of Canadians live in regions that have done so. You started this movement. Every one of you voted unanimously to pass our Vancouver climate emergency motion set an example for what taking real leadership on climate crisis looks like.
When council went on break, I interviewed two young climate activists who came to council with a sign reading, Students for Climate Action Now. This is what they had to say.
I guess to start out with, can you tell me a bit about who you are and why you're here today?
I'm Ella Winham. I'm a 16-year-old student at Van Tech in East Van. And I'm here because, I started to get involved with this movement back in December, and I've really, seen how it's grown, and it's been amazing to see, and it's been, so I've just gotten more and more involved with, the organizing, and it's been great to be a part of.
I'm Ursula Gavao, and I'm a recent graduate from Capilano, and I studied film, and I noticed how much waste is created because of the film industry and unnecessary transportation and everything, so I decided to get more involved with the climate change issue and try to change a little bit in the film industry to make it more green.
So when were you first motivated to take action on the issue of climate change?
I don't know, because my family is a very climate activist family, I guess. My mom was always involved with a lot of organizations, so it's sort of just always been a part of my life. But my biggest role was only ever attending protests with my family or with my friends, and so I guess, well, it's been nice to this is the next step, you know, there's never really been a great role for students to get involved with their own activism, and this is a movement that's really allowing youth and high school students, university students to organize for their own protests.
I don't actually know. My family is not really eco-friendly, and I guess when I moved to Vancouver and there's this whole thing about recycling and composting everything, I thought I was doing okay. But then I started learning more about climate change, and I saw that that wasn't enough. So I tried to change more things in my life, and I found sustainability on March 15th, and then I just started doing videos and promos for them.
What's the group that you said you were a part of?
I'm sorry?
You said that you were a part of a group?
Sustainability.
Can you tell me a bit about what sustainability is?
She would be better to answer that.
So basically we just started out as a group of youth doing some little strikes, which were based off of Greta Thunberg's strike for climate, which has gotten a lot of attention. So that was where we started out, and we grew into a more Metro Van wide movement, and our strikes have been growing, and now recently we've become part of a national network called Climate Strikes Canada, which is basically a connection between all these separate strike groups from all across Canada that have all come under the same name. So we're like the Metrovan section of that.
And so both of you are young, and you're going to feel the effects of climate change much longer than most of the people in City Hall will. How does this affect your motivation to address the issue of climate?
Most of the time I just feel very scared and powerless, and I feel like the protests and joining the groups like Sustainability Teens, it gives me more hope and see that more people are doing something about it. So it's just being afraid but still not being paralyzed, just doing something that could help.
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
Oh, I was just going to ask. I mean, both of you are young, and you're going to feel the effects of climate change a lot longer than most of the other people in City Hall at the moment. And I'm just wondering, like, how this affects your motivation to, like, talk about climate change, want to make a stand on it.
I think because it will have a bigger effect on us than other generations, it's definitely, like, more of a, like, a focus point, like, more at the front of everyone's mind than it is with older generations. So that really helps me to be motivated about this sort of stuff, because I know that this is, as the years go by, it's just going to affect my life more and more. It's not like going to go away, so I might as well do what I can about it, and that's sort of where my motivation comes from, I guess.
So what were your thoughts on the city staff's report that recommended 6 big moves for Vancouver to take on climate change?
I think they're pretty great. As some people were saying, some of the speakers were saying, that they are very, very bold, like possibly unachievable, although we don't want to think of them that way, of course. But I think that's what's necessary. And I'm really excited to see that my city is doing this, like taking this sort of extreme action. I'm pretty proud of Vancouver for what we've done so far, and I think it's great that we're just exponentially increasing what we're doing to combat this, and I really hope that it passes.
And your thoughts?
Well, I like it, and I think it's a good plan, but I don't think only the council needs to pass it, for sure, and it would really help to have those plans, but it also needs to reach the general public, because a lot of policies go through and they try to reach something, but they don't tell the actual general public what is going on, and they end up not doing anything because they're not aware of the problem and not aware that solutions are being implemented.
And actually, I've only got one more question. So, like, based on the activist work that you see from the people around you, like, are you confident that climate change is something that, like, we are, like, addressing adequately? Or, do you feel confident that climate change is something we can address? Or do you think we need to be doing more?
I always think we need to do more, but sometimes I just don't know how to do more, because it's a pretty big problem, and I feel like a lot of people are not aware of it or don't know the scale of the problem, so I don't know how to change that. But
well, I think there's always a chance to do more. In terms of the current environmentalism movement, there's so much great stuff going on, and I think some groups are just doing so much, it's crazy. But there are still a lot of people who are very uneducated about this, and also people who like get too scared about it, that feel like there's just like nothing we can do, so why bother trying? So I think in those ways there is more that we could do. Really need to make people realize that this is not just something we can ignore and hope that it gets better. So yeah, there's more we could do.
And that's actually all I got. Is there anything else you wanted to add before I go?
There's a climate strike on May 3rd, 1 to 4 p.m. at the Vancouver Art Gallery. Anybody's welcome. We hope to see you there.
I also got to talk to Christine Boyle, the Vancouver councillor who initially proposed the motion to declare a climate emergency back in January. I asked about her thoughts both on the report and the current state of climate change activism.
So, yeah, do you think, I guess, you could tell our listeners a little bit about who you are?
Sure. So I'm a first-term city councillor. I got elected for the first time in October, and I've been doing climate and inequality work for my whole adult life.
And so just kind of a basic question to start out with. What are your thoughts on the 6 big moves that the staff came up with?
I'm excited about them. They're ambitious. We've heard a number of people say they're technically possible, but they're really going to push us, and I think that's exactly where we need to be in light of the scale of the climate crisis and the amount of inaction globally until now. I'm really glad that we're being that ambitious.
And is there maybe anything from the report that you think was missing or that it didn't address or talk about?
There's a couple things that I would have liked to do faster, and we've heard from staff that this report really pushes the limits of what's technically possible, and I respect that, even though I just feel such a huge sense of urgency about wanting to move quickly on all of this.
What were the things that you wanted to work on faster?
Well, a couple really key pieces that are in the motion, in the report already, are around when we ramp down natural gas use in buildings. And so I think it really matters to start sending signals soon. One of the things staff are looking at is the date at which new furnaces and hot water heaters have to be electric. And I'd like that new date to be 2021. So that we're really starting to shift the market and get off of gas. It'll depend on what products are available and the amount of folks that are trained to be able to implement them, I hear. That's the technical limitation. But on natural gas, I think we need a quick date.
Actually, what was the date that they did set in for natural gas?
So the date in the report is that by 2025, all new and replacement furnaces and hot water heaters will be electric. And in the report, it lays out that the goal would be 2021. So staff are just figuring out those technical limitations and what we could make possible. And we'll hear back from that one, okay, from them on that pretty soon.
And yeah, a lot of these goals are very ambitious. Do you think that the city can achieve them all by the dates listed, or are they more like aspirational goals where you try to do as well as you can?
I think we need to achieve them. That's the science. And we're only going to achieve them if we really prioritize it, which is why I'm glad this report came back so quickly and we can keep moving quickly on implementing them. And then we're going to need to stay on top of them, and we're going to need residents in Vancouver to keep pushing that this matters to them, because it's going to need to be a big priority for years to come.
Are there any obstacles that you expect might come up in trying to achieve these goals?
People resist change often, even these changes, which we've heard from speakers will improve quality of life for people in Vancouver, improve health outcomes and all of those things. Still, change is hard, and the affordability crisis makes it even harder for a lot of people to imagine prioritizing anything above, you know, economic stability. And that's a local conversation, that's a national conversation. So it's one we need to be having in a different way than pitting jobs and climate action against one another.
And of all the goals, which one do you think will be the most challenging?
Well, the most impactful is this big move number four around zero emission buildings. I think that's going to be really challenging and also is so critically important to get done.
And the next question is something that I was kind of wondering about while listening to all the speakers, and it was something that Peter Ladner talked about a bit too. You know, Vancouver is just one city. We could take major climate action, but a lot of major governments around the world might not be taking similar actions. So what do you see as like the importance of taking strong climate action in light of this?
It matters so much that we start doing what needs to be done and set that as the example and the standard at every level. So I think wherever we can do that, and in Vancouver we're one example, we need to be setting plans that match the science and then expect that other levels of government will do the same. And also, I know that we've had more than 100 municipalities reach out to Vancouver, you know, who are watching these big moves, who are curious about what we do, because they're getting pushed to do more in their own region, and they know we can all learn from one another. So in that manner, too, Vancouver's action will have a bigger impact than just in our region.
A lot of speakers came out to talk about this. What were your thoughts on the speakers and what they had to say?
It's really valuable to have that broad perspective from many different disciplines and backgrounds on why this matters. And in particular, I am so moved all the time by hearing students and young people speak about what this means for them being able to have some hope in their future. And it's going to be hard, so it just matters that people continue to mobilize. Social movement pressure and mobilization at every level of government is so critical in getting the level of climate action that we need. And so people's presence here and people's words and people's emails and letters makes a big difference.
And there's been a lot of increased talk about addressing climate change since the new IPCC report came out in October. Are you confident for the future in the fight against climate change?
I am hopeful, yeah. I think we've seen lots of reasons to be hopeful in the student strikes globally, in conversations around a Green New Deal in the U.S. and what that might look like here in Canada, and in cities and municipalities taking action all over the place. I think the conversation is shifting, and I'm pretty honored to get to play my role in it from council here in Vancouver.
Awesome. That's all I got. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Voting on the motion to approve the report, along with the six big steps it outlines, was pushed back to Monday.
And we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9. It is 5:28 p.m. Today, we're focusing on climate change at the municipal level. We just heard a report from City Hall where council was presented with a report containing six recommendations for mitigating climate change in the city.
We're now going to switch gears a bit and chat about a report council presented the day before. On Tuesday, April 23rd, council heard the resilience report, which makes recommendations on how to deal with and adapt to climate change and extreme weather.
The City Council approved the framework for Vancouver's first ever resilience strategy on Tuesday. Max Newman did some research on this. So, Max, can you tell us what the Resilient Vancouver strategy is all about?
Sure. Resilient Vancouver is a citywide strategy which identifies key challenges the city is likely to face or is already facing and makes recommendations on how to deal with them. Vancouver's first chief resiliency officer, which is a position created 2 years ago with Katie McPherson's hiring, reported in front of council on Tuesday. It was a first look at the strategy report for the council.
So can you give us some context and explain a little bit about how this is going and what the report on Tuesday focused on?
McPherson told council that the city's top resilience challenges are surviving damaging earthquakes and extreme weather and how they interact with social inequity and isolation, the aging infrastructure, and of course the affordability crisis. So the strategy is the result of a two-year process involving stakeholders, experts, and community groups in addition to city departments.
So what are the areas of concern in Vancouver at the moment?
So there are three areas. The first one is called thriving and prepared neighborhoods. The second is proactive and collaborative government. And last but not least, safe, adaptive buildings and infrastructure.
Okay. So what sort of strategies is the city going to undertake to address these areas specifically?
So the report says that the whole strategy builds on a strong foundation of work underway across Vancouver's communities and promotes local action and partnerships to increase the city's resilience. And as you mentioned before, the framework for the strategy just got approved by the City Council. So the full strategy and actions still need to be finalized.
Okay. So is there anything like immediately happening thanks to Council's endorsement on Tuesday?
Yes, there will be two immediate actions taking place over the coming month. This includes launching a resilient neighborhoods program and developing policy options to reduce seismic risk.
Okay. So we have some plans here. Could we just talk a little bit about why this is necessary? What did you find out about that?
As we all know, Vancouver's at a significant risk of a damaging earthquake, and one of the major risks is damaging to buildings. According to McPherson, the problem is that most of Vancouver's buildings were built before rubber seismic design standards came into effect in the 1990s. Most of the drainage and sewer infrastructure was installed in the 50s and 60s, so long before climate change was factored into engineering. A 2016 investigation by Post Media reporter Gordon Hoekstra also revealed that Vancouver had failed to create a plan to reduce the seismic hazard of the city's thousands of older privately owned buildings, despite identifying a need to do so more than 20 years earlier.
All right, so this is definitely a plan that's going to have some implications in the city here. Is the city, beyond just fixing what we know is broken, doing anything to look into what we might not be aware of?
Yes, so the city is working on refining risk assessment and is developing a set of policy options to improve the performance of buildings in Vancouver. They want to reduce risk to residents, businesses, and critical infrastructure.
Okay, so with the affordability crisis, this could get a little bit complicated.
So reducing seismic risk for existing buildings definitely need to be evaluated alongside ensuring affordability, advanced accessibility, and adapting to climate change.
All right, so one more question before we cut it off and go to the next thing. I'm curious, how did council vote on the strategy report on Tuesday?
Yeah, the council voted 9-2 to have staff complete the resiliency strategy and implementation plan, although some councillors asked for more clarity about financial implications.
All right.
All right. Well, thanks for that, guys. Thanks for doing that research, Max. All right. So in studio with us now, we have Brayla Kwan, who's a journalist and a student at the UBC School of Journalism. And Josh and Sam have a few questions to ask her about related reporting, since we're covering climate change at the municipal level on today's show. She has done some reporting for The Thunderbird, which is the UBC School of Journalism's online publication. So I'll let you two take it away, Josh and Sam, and welcome Brayla.
Hey, Brayla. It's good to have you here.
Hi.
So can you tell me a bit about the reporting you did on sustainability for The Thunderbird?
Right. So I got in touch with them because I was interested in the global youth-driven climate movement that was going on, started by Greta from Sweden. So I wanted to find out more about what was happening at the local level here and why these kids cared and why they were skipping or striking for school.
Oh, also a bit of background information, I should say, for my readers. Sustainability Teens was the organization that the two kids I interviewed in my report, that's the group that they were a part of. So how did this group form?
From my knowledge, I think Rebecca was one of the teens you spoke to, and I spoke to her as well. She told me that she was kind of interested in getting school strike started in Vancouver, so she kind of started reaching out to her network of people that care. She described to me that she's kind of always been interested in environmentalism. So she reached out, and then I think through social media, which has been a huge power of, I think, this generation, they've been able to mobilize and organize.
And so what is their specific mandate? Like, do they have any, like, specific climate-related goals, or?
I think their main goal is to just getting people in power, people who have the authority to make decisions, to listen to what scientists are saying in regard to climate change. And, I think something that I've actually heard a lot of, a slight nuance, is just that, like, some leaders are kind of saying that how great it is that we have these younger people and how smart they are, and how, like, they're just going to fix it all. When in reality, I think we have a lot of kids saying, no, like, we need you to step up. We're just here to hold you to account.
And I understand that you went to one of the rallies on March 15th outside the art gallery. What did this rally look like?
It was huge. There's people of all ages, a lot of youth. I got to speak to a couple to take their pictures, and they're all there for various reasons. People of different ages. I saw some, like, super young people. At one point I saw a boy that was he was younger than 10 for sure. He was just handed a piece of chalk, and he just, like, the first day, without even thinking, he just, like, wrote down 11 year countdown on the pavement, which was kind of cool because he was referencing the IPCC report and he was so young.
Amazing.
Yeah, so people of all ages, adults too.
So here's kind of a more overarching, like, kind of general question. Why do you think it is that the youth, and I guess specifically kind of like young Generation Z youth, are taking so much action on climate change more and more these days?
Totally. There's a generational shift for sure. And I think, I don't want to speak on behalf of them, but something that Rebecca did mention to me was that at the core of it, it's a justice issue in the terms of it's their future, and they didn't contribute much to this mess, you could call it. And something that was also really insightful to hear was the other coin of justice, is she said the privilege that she has being in North America, and, like, her actions, the impacts they have in, like, developing countries, and, like, that side of justice as well. So I think that's a big part of it for them.
And I remember when I was actually reading your Thunderbird article, one of the things you talked about was how, I guess, youth who grow up today, they have more access to information thanks to things like the internet. How much of a role do you think that things like the internet plays in this activism?
I think very pivotal role.
Very pivotal.
Social media, because that allows them to connect, and then even just, like, access to science is
so different as education changes, like people learn about these things in school, or even like the IPCC knowledge is like very public and like very blasted on social media as well. So everything's just more accessible.
And where do you think this youth climate movement is going to go next?
I don't know. I don't see it stopping. And I think that's when people who make critique it may say, like, this is a trend right now, like it may be watered down. But from the like what it seems like is these kids are continuing to organize, and even Greta, like, she's making like huge waves internationally. So it doesn't seem like it's going to die down. And I think that they're going to keep organizing and waiting for change to happen, as we're seeing in Vancouver.
Yeah, so just building on Josh's last question there, as far as like what you've heard in the studio about the climate emergency response plan, just specifically to Vancouver with the six big moves and some of the ways those might be achieved, what kind of role do you see activist groups like Sustainabilityans playing going forward in this process? Maybe like sort of an accountability thing, or sort of, I was just wondering what your take on that was as someone who's written and observed.
I think just having the, for Sustainabilityans specifically, having those like young faces continuously showing up at City Hall is like a huge reminder of like who they're standing up for and like what they're trying to represent. So as long as they keep showing up, I think people will keep listening to them, because it is like a crazy thing to see these like young people who like maybe like they're too young to vote, but like finding ways to have their voices heard.
In your article, what sort of stuck out to me was the sense of urgency that a lot of these young people feel, and that people have felt throughout time. And I was curious if you think that this plan by city staff, given how ambitious it is maybe going to sort of soothe that sense of urgency, like something's being done amongst these groups, or do you think maybe they're a little bit more cynical? Do you think it's not going to like curb their sense of like, oh, things are, you know, going really badly?
I think joining together for them, a huge thing is that it has given them hope and something to look forward to. So with the motion when it passed in January, I think that was just like a win for them. And I think that they're going to keep organizing to support these wins. And like they'll probably, like I'm guessing they'll probably show up to City Hall on Monday again and keep making sure that they're showing their support for the things that they are, that the things that are going to affect them.
All right. I actually think that's about all we got. Is there anything else you'd like to add that we maybe haven't talked about?
No, I think that's great.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
No problem.
Cheers.
Great. Thanks so much, Brayla. So we're just going to take a short break, and then we're going to return. We have an interview that happened last minute with the NDP Housing Minister, Selena Robinson, and we talk about the decommodification of housing. And so that'll be happening shortly. So please stay tuned. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. We will be back in a second.
I think the New Testament.
The question is, Pilate, you remember Pilate from the New Testament?
What's this Pilate? He fiddled while...
just a minute. Let me ask the question, then you can give me the answer, okay? Did Pilate want Jesus to be crucified?
Pontius Pilate washed his hands of it.
So did he want him to be crucified?
Yeah.
No. No. No.
Well, tune in every Friday afternoon, 3:30 to the Night Rush Show on CITR.
Well, find a good church. It'll help you.
Are you a friend of ours who loves to get discounts? Come down to CITR for deals and you can count. We've partnered with some local businesses. So come down to us to get your card before it's too late.
As a member of CITR Discord, you get amazing deals with some of Vancouver's finest local businesses, such as Corner's Pub, Australian Boot Company, The Bike Kitchen, Rufus Guitar Shop, Vinyl Records, and the Cinematheque. For more information, visit citr.ca/friends.
Hello, and we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. That was just a really quick break. This is Democracy Watch's The News Collective's weekly local news report. So we've been focusing on climate change today because the city of Vancouver just heard a climate report on ways they can deal with the climate emergency we're in and ways we can mitigate our impact and our fossil fuel output in order to, you know, prevent warming the planet more than is already inevitable. And there also was a report that came out on Tuesday called the Resilience Report, which we went over, which focuses on ways the city of Vancouver can adapt to changes in weather patterns and emergencies like earthquakes. So a lot of really interesting climate change related local policy and reporting has been happening this week. We're going to shift a little bit right now to housing, which is a topic we cover quite a bit. So on Tuesday night, myself and Jonathan Q, who's not a member of the News Collective, but he's in policy school here at UBC and a member of the station, we went to a housing policy event put on by SFU. It took place at one of their downtown locations, and it featured a professor named David Madden, who was visiting and did sort of a whole history on the commodification of housing over time. So how it became a commodity, because it wasn't always that way. And it was very interesting. And there were a few other panelists, Penny Gersten from the School of Planning at UBC, as well as it was moderated by Jen St. Denis, a Star Metro reporter. She does a lot of stuff on housing. And there was Selena Robinson, who is our provincial minister of municipal affairs and housing. So I wanted to ask a few housing related questions to Minister Robinson after the event, but she had to rush out because the event was focused more on a historical and academic analysis or overview of the history of housing. And so I wanted to ask some more direct questions about specific provincial policy that is in place right now. So I talked to her about how the provincial government is dealing with our housing crisis and perhaps even working to decommodify housing in BC. So let's take a listen to this interview, and you can hear what Minister Robinson had to say. Here we go. Hello?
Hello, is this Alex?
Yes. Is this Minister Robinson?
It is. How are you? I'm sorry I couldn't stay that night. It was just such a long night, and I was exhausted.
Yeah, no worries. That's totally fine. I appreciate you finding the time to chat with me today.
Yeah, this is great.
Yeah. Well, thanks very much. I know you only have a few minutes, so I was at the SFU housing panel, as you know, and so I just had a few questions that came up during that panel, so that's what these questions relate to. So you mentioned a $7 billion housing fund. I was just wondering if you can tell me a few more specifics about that.
Sure. So back in February 2018, as part of our budget, we identified a $7 billion over 10 years to build the kind of housing, that right supply piece that we talked about, to make sure that we were building the kind of social housing that people need. And that's everything from supportive housing for people who are homeless, making sure that there's housing for them that come with supports. We have a fund, so that's one fund. We have another fund for Indigenous housing, both on and off reserve. We're the only province that is building on reserve housing for First Nations. That is that's about making sure that people, no matter where they live in British Columbia, have access to the kinds of housing they need. A third fund is for women and children fleeing violence. It's been 20 years since government has had a dedicated fund to build the kind of housing that those women and those families need. That's everything from, from the crisis point right through to second stage housing, so that they can get women can get their lives together, figure out what their next steps are. So that's a third fund. And the fourth fund, which is our largest fund, it's $1.9 billion. For over 10 years, and that's to build the affordable housing for seniors and families. in communities right around the province. So this fourth fund, we already have 4,900 units in process that are in development, whether there's a shovel in the ground for some of them, and others are still going before city councils for permitting. So they're in various stages right around the province.
Okay, so is that funding going towards your 30-point housing plan?
Yeah, so one major piece of the 30-point housing plan was that we needed funds to build the kind of social housing that and subsidized housing and affordable housing that people need. So that's a key component of our 30-point plan, is to make sure that there's funding. And so just to give you a sense of scope, the previous government over 16 years built 27,000 units of housing. Of social housing, right, over 16 years. Mm-hmm. We've been at this for just over a year, and we have 17,000 homes in process.
Mm-hmm.
That's just to give you a sense of the scale and the scope.
Is that social housing?
So all of that, all the housing that I described is considered social housing because it's subsidized. So government is subsidizing it.
Okay. Right. But it is for a variety of different levels of incomes. Correct.
Right, exactly, yeah. Right? So people have, we're all not the same. So there are some people who are on welfare rates, and there's other people that, they're not, they're working what we'd call working poor, or they're working, we can even say middle class, and mm-hmm. still struggling to find housing. So right. We're looking at that full range of where we need subsidy dollars.
And then the $7 billion fund, is that money that you're acquiring through taxation, or is it from the federal government?
No, this is provincial funding. So the federal government has some opportunities to help us leverage. So where it makes sense, we are partnering with the federal government. There's additional funds, and so we can match. And that means so their housing, their supports come from a different bucket, and so we can deliver a lot more when we match with the federal government. And with ours, this is a $7 billion fund that is for over a 10-year period.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I wanted to ask about that, and the 30-point plan also spans over 10 years. So what happens if there's a change in provincial government?
Well, I hope there isn't. Because
what happens if there is, though?
In 2001, there was a change in government,
mm-hmm.
and every single project that the previous NDP government had in the pipeline got canceled.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happens.
So basically, right? A lot might not come to fruition if
the government changes.
Yeah.
They can make a different decision. And mm-hmm. history has shown us, and this is very partisan, because I asked the question, what happened in 2001? And I was informed by staff who were around that every single project was canceled. So I think it's important that your listeners know. So when we became into government, we didn't cancel a single project.
Mm.
Not a single project was canceled. And we looked at every single project that the BC Liberals had in the pipeline, and we determined whether or not they were really, truly affordable, because their criteria was 10% below market was considered affordable, and we said that wasn't acceptable. And we actually put money in to make them more affordable. So not only did we keep those projects going, but we actually deepened the affordability.
Right.
And so we're continuing to bring more online.
Right. I wanted to ask about something that I found that didn't come up in the panel. So we were talking about the panel, the panelists, you and the other panelists were speaking about the decommodification of housing, how that's possible, how it has become commodified. And I'm wondering, what about vacancy control as a way to decommodify housing? That seems like it could be a viable and sort of quick way to turn housing back into homes for BCers. Is that totally off the table for this government?
Well, it's an interesting question that you ask. And, with vacancy control, you tie the rent to the unit,
mm-hmm.
right, instead of to the renter. And so what that happens is you have this tremendous risk, you create this risk that you don't actually get investments into aging housing, right? So part of our problem mm-hmm. is not so much that, it's that there's been a 40-year gap without any purpose-built rental being built. So what typically happens, if you continue to have purpose-built rental continuously built over the long term, your oldest stock becomes your more affordable housing, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because it, right? And you, but you keep building new housing, new affordable, new, it's not affordable, new rental stock. Mm-hmm. And people who can pay more will pay more, and people who, but you always have the regeneration, right? That's continuing. Mm-hmm. What we have here is a 40-year gap. So all we have is stuff that's being built in the last, let's say, 18 months that's coming online, and stuff that's 40 years old. Mm-hmm. And we have nothing in between, and that's why, that's part of the reason why we are in such a pickle, because we don't have stuff that's 15 years old. We don't have anything that's 22 years old because it wasn't being built. Mm-hmm. And that was when the federal government sort of got out of the business of supporting the development of purpose-built rental, right? There needed to be some incentives.
So you're afraid.
Incentives.
So it's like,
so
if...
I'm afraid that what will happen is that old stock will go into disrepair,
right.
And then people are living in really substandard housing, which is dangerous. And then that gets sold to build condos, which
right.
I think would be terrible. So I don't want to make things worse.
But
and
right,
that's what I worry about.
But then, I mean, right now, rental prices, at least in Vancouver, are going steadily up, although the city has a lot of incentive programs
seeing,
to subsidize rental construction.
We're actually seeing that it's starting to stabilize is what we're starting to see, right? So, again, you know, we've taken some very significant big steps in the last year. There's more coming. We have a rental housing task force, so there's more recommendations that we're reviewing as we speak. So there's more for us to do, absolutely. But we also need to see how these measures play out. And so we're already starting to see the beginnings of a flattening of rental prices, so they're not going up, and we're seeing it sort of leveling off and maybe even dipping a tiny, tiny bit.
Right.
I'm holding my breath. I am holding my breath and hoping that it will start to, we'll start to see a little bit of a drop. But we have to see how these current steps play out, because if we do too much, you risk sort of toppling everything over. So it is important that we take action and we see how it impacts on rents and making sure that we can get back to some more affordability.
Right. So the 23 recommendations that were made by the Rental Housing Task Force are the beginning, and it's possible that vacancy control might be a future recommendation?
Well, it wasn't a recommendation in there. It was not. And again, we've already taken some significant steps. We got rid of the fixed term lease loophole, so we got rid of that. We increased a significant amount of resources to the residential tenancy branch, including putting in a compliance unit to get compliance. We just had our first administrative penalty to a landlord who wasn't doing what they were supposed to do. So we're actually starting to penalize people who don't play by the rules. And that never existed before.
When did that start, the penalization? Because in Port Coquitlam, I know they've been doing a lot to fight against rent eviction, and they've been saying that there hasn't been any action from the provincial government to actually end rent evictions, though that was one of the recommendations.
Well, like I said, the recommendations are before us right now, so we're still making sure that we do the policy work to see how things play out. So that work is all underway. And like I've said to others, we can't fix 16 years of neglect in two. So we are taking a look. We are unpacking the pieces. We are identifying where we need to intervene in order to bring affordability back to the housing situation here in British Columbia.
Right. So just with the rent evictions, I understand you have received the recommendations and you're analyzing them, but when do you project you'll be acting on them?
Well, that is, you know, here in the next number of weeks, what the plan is.
Okay.
We're just putting that together.
Okay, there's going to be an announcement in the next couple of weeks?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So, like, we said that we would have something, you know, late spring, early summer, that because we needed the time to analyze them, take a look to see sort of where they fit in a work plan, identify, you know, what it would look like, what needs more policy work, what needs more consultation. And so that work is continuing. And we should have something the next number of weeks that we can report out on.
Okay, cool. The last question I have before I let you go is... the provincial government, your government, has built 600 temporary modular homes in Vancouver, and the city has requested funding to build 600 more. I'm wondering if you know what the status of that is.
Well, I've, in fact, I just had a very brief meeting with the mayor of Vancouver. a conversation we're continuing to have. We have, as part of budget 2018, when I talked about the modular, we have an additional 2,500. So we had an initial 2,000 in 2017. Our commitment was to build 2,000 of those supportive modular homes, right? Mm-hmm. And so Vancouver got 606. February 2018, we said we're going to do 2,500 more over the next 10 years. And so that is, there's some funding there. And in budget 2019, we identified an additional 200 for this year alone. So all told, that's 4,700 units over 10 years. We've rolled out about 2,000, just over 2,000 are committed. Mm-hmm. So that is a discussion we're continuing to have with the city to see what makes sense, what's possible, and we'll continue to have those conversations moving forward.
Okay. Thank you so much, Minister Robinson, for taking out your time.
You're very, very welcome. Thank you.
Great. Have a nice day.
You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you for listening. That was an interview I did. My name is Alex DeBoer with the NDP Housing Minister, Selena Robinson. It was uncut, so that was the uncut interview. It was raw.
Raw news.
So I'll probably throw that up on our podcast, Seeking Office, maybe edit it just a little bit so you don't hear the phone call and stuff. But so thanks for listening to our show today.
And if you want some more news on the Lower Mainland, tune in next week at Thursday at 5 p.m. and you can hear some more good stuff.
Yeah.
And be sure to subscribe to our podcast, Seeking Office. It's available on CITR or anywhere you get your podcasts. Right, Alex?
Essentially. Yeah, so thanks very much for tuning in to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Up next, we have the Spencer Lotu Show. So please stay tuned. That's what show we have up next, right?
I'm pretty sure it is.
I mean, I saw the guy come in.
We're pretty sure it's the Spencer Lotu Show. If not, there will be other excellent CITR programming. Thanks again. See you, or you'll hear us again next Thursday at 5. Bye-bye.